People come from all over the world to walk the Milford Track and begin their adventure here with a boat trip from Teano Downs. Running 53.5 kilometres from Lake Teano to Milford Sound, the Milford Track is one of the world's greatest wilderness walks, attracting 14,000 trampers a year. Most of these pass through during the walking season, which runs from late October through April. It takes 4 days to walk the track, with 3 overnight stops at comfortable huts. It's well worth the effort. Walkers are rewarded with some of the most spectacular scenery in the world. Soaring peaks, mighty waterfalls, rugged rock faces, ancient forest, glassy lakes and turbulent rivers make up a magical world untouched by the passage of time. Walking the Milford Track is an experience that remains with you for life. This is one reason why people have been coming here for more than 100 years. The track was established in 1888 as an overland route between Lake Teano and Milford Sound. Although local Māori had used the route to collect greenstone, the mountains were still a barrier to the settlers. The way through was found by one of the area's pioneer settlers, a talented bush navigator and local character called Quinton MacKinnon, originally from the Shetland Isles in Scotland. The 1,000-metre-high pass was named after him, and he became the track's first guide. Visitors were in good hands with MacKinnon. He was good-natured, knowledgeable, and baked a mean pompolona, a type of scone. They would board his sailing boat for the ride up the lake to the start of the track. Then he'd take them up over his pass, across Lake Ada, and down to Donald Sutherland's hotel at Milford Sound. Until the highway was finished in 1954, the only way back was to turn around and walk out again. Word soon spread about this great new walk, and by 1890 it needed an upgrade. The plan was to turn it into a road with cuttings and overnight huts. This was no mean feat. The rock around here is very, very hard, and you can imagine that conditions in those days were tough. Unfortunately, the elements won over, and the road idea was downgraded to a packhorse track. When the Public Works Department finally finished the job, tourist numbers increased, and in 1900 more than 100 trampers walked the track. In 1908, the London Spectator secured its reputation by calling it the finest walk in the world. Unfortunately, MacKinnon himself didn't live to hear this, having drowned in Lake Teano in 1892. But he's remembered in some of the names along the track: Pompolona Lodge, St. Quinton Falls, and of course, MacKinnon Pass. If you plan to walk the track, take the ferry from Teano Downs to Glade Wharf at the head of the lake. The track starts there and ends at Sandfly Point on Milford Sound, where another ferry connects with the road. At the end, you can either return to Teano by bus or stay a while to enjoy Milford Sound. Up to 40 independent trampers may start the walk per day, along with a similar number of guided walkers. Each day on the track is a fresh adventure. On day one, you follow the Clinton River through ancient beech forest and across 9 suspension bridges. There's a lot more walking on day two as the track heads up to the base of MacKinnon Pass. You'll conquer the steepest section of the track, pass into alpine grassland and see waterfalls, lakes and ice caps. The best of the scenery comes on day three as you cross the mountains and check out the incredible views from the MacKinnon Pass. Many trampers find this day the most challenging, but there's a chance to freshen up at the mighty Sutherland Falls. It's a side trip from the main track, but highly recommended, being the 5th highest waterfall in the world and the highest in New Zealand. Donald Sutherland discovered the 580-metre cascade in 1880, but nobody knew where all the water came from until Mr. Quill bravely climbed the falls 10 years later and discovered Lake Quill at the top. On day 4, there's a gentle descent along the rainforested banks of the Arthur River via Bell Rock and Lake Ada to its mouth in Milford Sound. There are day shelters along the track, as well as notable toilet facilities. One lonely pit stop is all that remains of the original first night hut, which was eroded away by the river. Another boasts what could be the finest view from a loo in the world. In one of the guided walkers' huts, Quinton Lodge, there's even an old piano. One look at the location and it's plain to see that manhandling it along the wild mountain track must have been pretty tricky. Walking the Milford Track is the adventure of a lifetime in a breathtaking wilderness far from civilization. We'll soon start to follow the Eglinton River down there on your left, which runs into Lake Teano from the mountains. The border of the Fiordland National Park runs along the far side, but soon it crosses the road and we'll pass into the national park. You'll start to notice less signs of settlement along the road and a lot more wilderness. It's a real privilege to drive through such incredible scenery and to know that you're on the only piece of tar seal in this vast and ancient landscape. In fact, there may be times when I'll let you admire the scenery in peace. And at other times, I'll have to let you concentrate on your driving because as we head through the mountains, there are a few bends in the road. But that's not for a while yet, so in the meantime, I'll give you a bit of background to the national park. The Fiordland National Park is the biggest in New Zealand, covering 21,000 square kilometres, which is about 8,000 square miles, or 1.2 million hectares. That's about the size of the state of New Jersey, or the country of Israel. It's mostly made up of forest and water, and covers the entire western corner of the South Island, running coast to coast from Martin's Bay in the north, down Lake Teano to Waitutu Forest on the south coast. More than 500 kilometres of walking tracks crisscross the park, supported by about 60 overnight huts. Among the park's geological features, you'll find New Zealand's deepest lake, Lake Hauroko, plus its highest waterfall, that's Sutherland Falls, as well as extinct volcanoes, active glaciers, and impossibly steep, jagged mountains. 14 fiords pierce a 200-mile stretch of seacoast, creating thousands of kilometres of shoreline. Fiordland gets plenty of weather. Strong westerly winds pick up moisture from the ocean, and when it hits these steep mountains, it's forced upwards, where it cools and turns to rain. Lots of rain. On the coast, you might get 8 metres of rain a year, and there are more rainy days than dry ones. But let's face it, you didn't come here to sunbathe. This is a land created and nourished by water, meaning it's absolutely teeming with life, some of the most precious life on the planet. From the ancient black coral in the waters of the fjords to the rare takahe in the mountains, from the primeval tree ferns to dripping forest mosses, Fiordland is unique and totally magical. In recognition of this, the first attempt to protect the area came in 1904. 940 hectares of land was set aside. That's about 80% of what the park covers today. This means that it was reserved as public land and an area of natural beauty, although commercial activities such as sealing and forestry continued. Meanwhile, people began to realize the importance of protecting threatened species. Early conservationists such as Richard Henry devoted their lives to transporting flightless birds such as kiwi and kakapo to the offshore islands where they'd be safe from predators. You'll be hearing more about Richard Henry later on. It wasn't until 1952 that Fiordland National Park, as we know it today, came into being. It's named after the fjords that give it its concertina coastline. Confusingly, all of the fjords are named sounds, among them Milford Sound, Doubtful Sound, and Dusky Sound. By definition, a sound is a narrow inlet carved out by an outgoing river or incoming sea. A fjord, on the other hand, is made by ice, not water. Like all New Zealand's national parks, Fiordland is managed by Department of Conservation, or DOC, a central government organisation in charge of conserving New Zealand's natural and historic heritage. In the Māori language, its name is Te Papa Atawhai, which can be roughly translated as nurturing the treasures. Here in Fiordland, DOC maintains the walking tracks, runs the huts, employs field guides, participates in scientific research, provides visitor facilities, maps and information, monitors the land and decides who can go where and when. Its work is crucial to the survival of the park, both as a tourist attraction and as a natural resource. In fact, DOC have a balancing act on their hands, as they have to run the park as a leisure facility without upsetting its delicate natural balance. Luckily, they now have the support of the World Heritage Organization. In 1990, Fiordland's star status was sealed when the park made the World Heritage List. It's a bit like winning an Oscar for being amazing and irreplaceable. It's awarded by UNESCO, a division of the United Nations, and it's not easy to win. A nominated area has to fulfill certain criteria, which essentially prove that the world can't do without it, on either cultural or natural grounds. The government also has to sign an agreement with UNESCO promising to look after the area. If it fails, World Heritage can step in and take away the government's rights to it. Well, the World Heritage people came over, had a look, made some reports, and finally decided that this area was worthy to join the world's list of most amazing places. They deemed that Fiordland has natural features of outstanding universal value and is home to a number of threatened species that couldn't survive without it. It was included as part of the Southwest New Zealand World Heritage Area, which also includes Mount Aspiring and Mount Cook National Parks. There are only two other World Heritage sites in New Zealand, a little group of Antarctic islands that not many people get to, and Tongariro National Park, a volcanic area on the North Island. So as you drive through this awesome landscape, you know that you are truly witnessing some of planet Earth's greatest treasures. And that's official. As you can see, most of Fiordland is covered with forest. You're looking at a lush blanket of plant life that has been thriving here since the last ice age. Some have not changed since the time of the dinosaurs. While all this cold and wet might not be ideal for you or I, there are thousands of species that love living here. From the tallest, oldest rimu standing high above the forest canopy, right down to the mosses and lichens in vibrant greens, yellows and reds. Every inch of this land is bursting with life. More than 700 plant species are found only in Fiordland, and new ones are still being discovered. That's partly how the park earns its World Heritage listing. Beech trees dominate the area. There are three species, but it's easiest to spot them by their leaves because their shape varies according to where they're growing. On flatland, they stand tall and straight, but when they're hanging off the side of a mountain, they grow gnarled and twisted, like something out of a fairy tale. Up near the tree line, they don't grow very high at all, and you can feel like a giant walking in an elfin forest. Other trees tower above the beeches. Our tallest tree is the kahikatea, or white pine, which can reach 60 meters. The rimu, one of our oldest species, can grow to 40 meters, with shaggy foliage trailing from black bark. Up in the mountains, you'll find the prickly crowns and stringy bark of the majestic totara, which can live for 1,000 years. You may also see some from the road as we pass through Totara Flat shortly, which is actually quite an unlikely spot for them to be growing. All these giants of the forest provide shelter for hundreds of other species, which form a thick understory. But there's one family of plants in particular that give the forest its primeval, jungly look, and that's the tree ferns. If they look like something from the age of the dinosaurs, that's because they are. They love damp, shady forest and have furry trunks exploding in a crown of leaves. The most famous is the silver fern, which can grow to 10 meters and is found only in New Zealand. Keep an eye out for large fern leaves with a silvery underside. The Maori use these to navigate at night by laying them silver side up on the forest floor where they reflected the moonlight. They're a national icon. You'll see fern emblems everywhere. There's even a call to get rid of our current national flag and use the silver fern instead. Many forest species don't need soil to grow. They clamber and cascade from every available foothold, filling every space and sometimes throttling each other in the process. Look at any tree and see how many other plants are living among its branches, with more plants living on them. Throw in a few creeper vines, some palm-like trees, and a thick carpet of moss on everything, and it's a jungle out there. On higher ground, trees bend, shrink, and then peter out altogether, giving way to beautiful mountain herbs, mosses, rushes, and wildflowers. There's barely a corner of this incredible land that isn't overflowing with life. And that's just the plants. There are some very special creatures living here too. Right now we're following the Eglinton River, which is home to one of them. There are not more than a couple of thousand of the ancient blue duck or pheeal left, and most of them live on remote rivers. Look out for a duck with a pale blue-gray body, chestnut speckles on its chest, and a dark greenish-gray head, with yellow eyes and a pale beak. Consider yourself very lucky if you see one. The blue duck isn't the only endangered bird around here. New Zealand is a land of birds. With almost no native land mammals, they evolved to fill the niche that mammals fill in other lands. Over time, some forgot how to fly. With no land predators, they had no need to. They got along fine until the Europeans turned up with dogs, cats, and rats, and that's when their troubles began. You remember the Takahe back there in the mountains and how we're trying to save it from extinction? There's also the Kia, a big green parrot, which has this distinctive call. Although there are only a few thousand Kia left, here in Fiordland we see them everywhere. They've survived these harsh conditions by being intelligent, inquisitive, and able to figure out ways to get a meal. And that's why we see so much of them, because they've learned how to score a free feed by hanging around tourists and looking cute and hungry. Sometimes they'll even pinch your picnic when you're not looking. But no matter how demanding they are, please resist feeding the Kia. Human food can make them very sick. The other problem is that if they don't have to find their own food, the Kia end up with plenty of free time on their hands, and a Kia with plenty of free time can be quite destructive, damaging or stealing your property. So enjoy meeting these creatures, but keep your things secure and don't encourage them. But our most precious bird is the kakapo, a flightless green parrot with an owlish face. It's even more endangered than the Takahe. There are now only 86 kakapo left in the world. It's a real shame that such a unique, intelligent bird is so close to extinction. In the 1970s, the last survivors were rounded up in Fiordland and transported to nearby islands for their own protection. There, Doc is managing to breed about 20 new chicks a year, so let's keep our fingers crossed for them. And of course, there's the famous kiwi, our national bird, which we New Zealanders are named after, along with our national currency and a small green fruit. For such a big part of our culture, kiwis are pretty hard to spot in the flesh. They only come out at night and are very shy and quiet, with hairy-looking plumage. You're more likely to hear one than see one, so listen out for their calls at night. Our three species of kiwi are all endangered, because 95% are killed by predators as chicks. To protect them, DOC have set up captive breeding programs in offshore island sanctuaries. In fact, if you recall, one of the first people to think of using the islands was Richard Henry, an Irishman who settled at Lake Te Anau in the 1880s. He was worried about the sudden decline in flightless bird numbers and set up the first island reserve in Dusky Sound. By 1890, he'd caught about 700 flightless birds and shipped them to the island in his little boat. Doc continues this work today, so those birds owe him one. We recommend stopping at Mirror Lakes. This is a great photo opportunity, but can be congested, so just watch out for the traffic and pedestrians.